Good afternoon, everyone. Please be seated. Welcome again. This is our fourth case to be heard today, but it's the very first day of oral arguments in the Nevada Court of Appeals, so you all get to be part of this historic event. And we've been very impressed with the quality of the argument we've seen. We found that it's very helpful. It's all very different for us because we're district court judges. But we're liking this experience, and we hope you all will enjoy this too. We're usually pretty nice, so relax. But you never know what's going to happen. Okay, the next case to be heard is number 64215, Miguel Guitron versus State of Nevada. This is an appeal from a judgment of conviction for charges of incest, sexual assault, and lewdness with a minor, and a jury verdict. And is it Ms. Feliciano? Okay. All right. Will you be arguing then for the appellant today?
Yes,
and if you could also introduce your co-counsel. Okay. Welcome to.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Judge Gibbons, Judge Tao, and Judge Silver, counsel for the state. I'm Amy Feliciano. I represent Miguel Guitron, and I'd ask at this time to reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal argument. In this appeal, we have raised four issues. I will first address the evidence sufficiency argument in conjunction with the denial of Mr. Guitron's motion to admit evidence relating to the alleged victim's sexual knowledge motion. I'll then next address the Batson versus Kentucky issue, and finally, with the denial of Mr. Guitron's instruction number K. Regarding the charge first on sufficiency of incest, the state did not present sufficient evidence at trial to establish that DA was Guitron's biological daughter. The state's sole argument on incest on appeal is somewhat illogical. The state argues that because the witnesses during the trial referred to Mr. Guitron as DA's father, that this demonstrates paternity beyond a reasonable doubt. This is akin to, you know, having a trial where the state or other witnesses refer to an alleged victim as a victim prior to any conviction, criminal conviction, declaring them a victim.
Well, in this case, Mr. Guitron's confession was admitted at trial and played, where he talks about it's his biological daughter. So that's an admission which can obviously be substantive evidence.
And that's correct, Your Honor. However, based on the fact that the state presented no other evidence to support paternity, that would present in and of itself a corpus delicti issue.
Was there any DNA evidence presented?
No, not as regard to with Mr. Guitron and DA. The only DNA evidence presented was between DA and Mr. Guitron as being the biological father. The state has somewhat taken the issue and focused on Crystal Star Guitron as supporting incest. Incest does not require that a child result from the sexual intercourse. As to Mr. Guitron and DA, there was no DNA evidence presented.
What about NRS 51.265, which provides that basically reputation among members of a person's family, blood, or marriage, or among his or her associates or in the community, is not inadmissible under the hearsay rule if it concerns his or her birth, marriage, divorce, death, et cetera, et cetera. And you're talking about, it wasn't raised in either brief, but certainly one can testify to who their mother or father is. Because, I mean, taking to its logical end, you would need DNA for every case.
Well, in this case, as far as DA testifying that he was her father and Mr. Guitron testifying that she was his daughter, this would be based on hearsay received solely from DA's mother, Anita. Anita described a paternity test, and that's how she knew. I objected to that and said that it was based not only on the best evidence rule, but based on double hearsay because of the testing that would have been done. And Anita did not testify that it established Mr. Guitron as the parent.
But Mr. Guitron also, in his statement to the detectives, also stated that he took a paternity test and acknowledged that this was, in fact, his child to the police.
He did receive the results, though. I believe he also had said that he received the results from Anita.
Ms. Feliciano, why don't you tell us the significance of the prior victim's knowledge of pornography from the Internet and how, and put that in conjunction with your defense in this case, which is statutory sexual seduction, and how that exclusion would require reversal by this court.
Okay, and that the denial of that is incredibly important because, you know, our defense, as you said, was statutory sexual seduction. Showing that DA had prior sexual knowledge to, you know, before any conduct with Mr. Guitron demonstrates that she, you know, that she was able to consent, that she knew what she was doing. You know, the state has argued that she was mentally incapable of understanding the nature of her conduct. However, she was viewing pornographic material, pornography websites. She had spoken at length with her mother regarding sexual activity, how babies were made, etc. And so the denial of us to be able to get into this at trial and say she had sexual knowledge, she knew what she was doing, this is exactly what Summit describes. And Summit says the average juror is going to think that a 12-year-old would have no sexual knowledge beyond that contained within the original charge.
Well, I mean, even if that's true, that that was error, considering that your client confessed to it and you're not challenging the admissibility of the confession, why isn't that just harmless error?
Well, what we are saying is that, well, he was convicted of sexual assault, and there was no doubt that this was an issue of whether there was consent and that the state was saying she was mentally incapable. Without us being able to show that she had prior sexual knowledge that she initiated, we were, you know, unable to present that she was in fact capable of understanding her actions. And so it is not harmless error. It's incredibly prejudicial. Again, as Summit says, the average juror is going to think a 12-year-old has no knowledge of sex prior to, you know, the instance that they're on trial for. Court's brief indulgence. And in Summit, the court stated that the inability to provide this information as a defense would be obvious error. The state, in fact, down below, when we argued on this motion, represented that it did not have to prove that she was incapable of consenting, only that she was unable to understand the nature of her conduct. Based on that, it's incredibly relevant that she had extensive prior sexual knowledge that predated Mr. Guitron's involvement, especially in the way that the description of the sexual activity occurred, that DA initiated the sexual activity, that she initiated it when Mr. Guitron had taken a pain pill, that she wanted to feel what a penis felt like inside of her, and that she continued the relationship.
But all of that did come out. That was not precluded at the jury trial. All of that came out, and you were able to argue this to the jury.
That's correct. It did come out. But the state used and said, well, she was manipulated, and Mr. Guitron, you know, manipulated her into this. If we were able to demonstrate to the jury and show the jury that DA had sexual interest and had looked at sexual activity prior to involvement with Mr. Guitron, it would therefore provide us with the defense that she was mentally capable of knowing what she was doing. At one point, DeShea testified that she even asked Mr. Guitron not to ejaculate inside of her because she did not want to become pregnant. And that's one of the state's main arguments, is that she had to fully understand the nature of her conduct. And so it's incredibly relevant.
Well, you were able to cross-examine her as to that as well, though.
I did.
And that did come out in front of the jury.
Exactly. But the state still argued that she was incapable of taking to the logical conclusion the ramifications of having a child with the biological father. That is not an element of sexual assault with the victim under the age of 14. There need not be, again, a resulting child. She need not be able to take that to its logical conclusion. The issue before the jury was whether she understood the nature of her conduct. And so the denial of showing her prior sexual knowledge prior to any, you know, involvement with Mr. Guitron, especially, as I said, with the state arguing that he was grooming her, that he was manipulating her, that he was, you know, trying to get her to continue in this activity, it gutted our defense in order to challenge that she was mentally capable of this. Court's indulgence. Again, and along those same lines with regard to the sexual assault, the state argues that, Crystal was the result of this intercourse, and that is just, again, a distraction on the state's part. There is no doubt that Crystal is the biological child of Mr. Guitron and D.A., but again, that has nothing to do with the charge that Mr. Guitron was convicted of. If I move on, I may move on to the Batson issue. Thank you. Regarding Batson, as this court well knows, the constitutional keystone of a fair trial is an impartial jury. There have been many previous Nevada Supreme Court decisions that have come out as of late that discuss the Batson requirements, and those include Connor versus State, Watson versus State, and Buchanan versus State. And basically, we have to establish first, the proponent has to establish that a prima facie case was made, and then if the judge determines it's been made, the state must offer a race-neutral reason. It then becomes the proponent's burden again to say that is no pretext, and then the district court makes the final determination. Here, in this case, the state exercised cause challenges, and I want to address the cause challenges first because I think they're important in the context of the peremptory challenges. The cause challenges were against persons for whom English was not their native language. The district court granted those cause challenges over the defense objection, even though we suggested that those people had a right to serve and that this has been done and accommodations have been made with interpreters previously before. Following there, the state then, upon peremptory challenges, exercised two of its peremptory challenges against minority jurors, and that was badges number 31 and 52. With regard to 31, Mr. Guitron made a contemporaneous objection arguing that a prima facie case had been made. At the time, the district court did not find that a prima facie case would be made, and so Mr. Guitron then objected contemporaneously when the state struck juror number 52, a black woman. At that time, the district court did then require race-neutral reason from the state. The state offered race-neutral reason. Mr. Guitron offered his traverse and stating why that race-neutral reason was mere pretext, pointing to other jurors who had given very similar answers. And those jurors included jurors number 47 and 24. There were numerous jurors in the veneer who had given the same answers, but Mr. Guitron didn't point that out. Ultimately, the district court denied Mr. Guitron's Batson challenge, accepting the race-neutral reasons, and based on the state's exercising its peremptory challenges, in addition with the cause challenges for discriminatory purposes, we would say that he was denied a fair trial based on Batson. I know I'm running out of time. I'm just going to briefly touch on Instruction K. I submitted this instruction as under Allen versus State, my theory of the case instruction, and Crawford versus State. It was denied this instruction. Allen versus State and then Williams versus State and Crawford versus State have to be read in conjunction with each other. It's kind of a trifecta in the law where they build upon each other, saying that we're entitled to our theory of defense instruction. Now, that may be an inverse, which is what I offered here. That may be a different type of, I've crafted different instructions upon my theory of defense instruction, but here my instruction was an inverse instruction. It was denied because the district court concluded that it didn't understand that that was my defense theory. The district court instead imposed its own opinion as to my defense theory without any factual basis, saying that my defense theory was that the state was not able to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, and then I would then argue that we'd have to look at Instruction K. I would say that is reversible error, that the judge abused her discretion in making that finding and that the jury was misled, excuse me, with regard to that instruction. And with that, unless there are questions, I'd like to reserve my very limited time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Feliciano.
All right, 2 minutes for rebuttal. All right, Ms. Luzach, are you arguing for the state today?
I am.
All right, you can introduce your co-counsel, too.
My co-counsel is Danielle Piper. She will not be arguing.
Oh. We might have to ask her a question anyway.
That would be great, actually. May it please the Court, my name is Lisa Luzach, and I represent the state of Nevada. And I suggest to the Court that the state did not prove this case with sufficient evidence. The state proved this case by overwhelming evidence.
I want to go to the inverse instruction that Ms. Feliciano left off with. And I want to, appellant claims that the district court erred by refusing to give that instruction. And in light of the Crawford case, how do you reconcile the judge's ruling in light of Crawford?
The instructions that were given were very, very clear in that if the state did not prove every element of every offense beyond a reasonable doubt that they had to find the defendant not guilty, their defense was that there was consent, in other words, that it wasn't against her will or under conditions in which DeShea didn't understand the consequences of her act.
But Crawford specifically says that the district court may not refuse to give a proposed instruction simply because it's substantially covered by other instructions given.
I recognize that, and I still suggest that the instructions were more than sufficient. However, the court has also stated that if there is error in not giving the instruction, it could be harmless error in a case where the evidence is proven by overwhelming evidence. And in this case, I would suggest that the verdicts that the jury returned were not because there was no inverse instruction. Even with an inverse instruction that said, if you found that DeShea consented, you would have to find him not guilty, even under those circumstances, I suggest that they would still have found him guilty of all the counts because of the overwhelming evidence. Specifically, as it pertains to the incest, the appellant is concerned that there was no DNA or any physical evidence demonstrating that DeShea is, in fact, the defendant's daughter. Anita Anderson, who is the mother of DeShea, testified that she and Miguel Gutron had a relationship. They engaged in sexual intercourse. While they were dating, she got pregnant, and then she moved out of town, didn't tell him. That, I suggest, is evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. She's the one who had sex, got pregnant. She knows who the father is. But that, combined with admissions.
Did she limit that? Her relationship was only with him, so there were no other possible fathers?
There was no evidence to suggest that there were any other possible fathers. She was young. She intimated that it was, a one-on-one relationship, that there was nobody else. But no, she didn't affirmatively testify that there were no other fathers. But as far as Corpus is concerned, her statement that he is the father, and I know that because we had sex and I got pregnant, certainly gives the state the reason to bring in the defendant's admission, which he admitted to pretty much everyone on the planet, face-to-face as well as through an abundant number of letters that he wrote to DeShea afterwards, up through and including during the trial, admitting that he was the father. So the incest was absolutely proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
What is the extreme prejudice that you were claiming in preventing or arguing against in the district court, ultimately ruling in favor, on excluding the victim's knowledge of the internet at 12 or 13 years old, albeit pornography? When the court reviewed the district court's record, basically the state talked about prejudice and almost equated it with the rape shield laws, which it's really not. It's just to show knowledge of what she'd seen on the internet, perhaps to bolster their defense, which is sexual seduction.
And I'm going to answer that backwards, if I may. The case of Summit, which the defense cites to bring in that evidence, suggests that jurors are going to look at a 12-year-old, a 6-year-old, whoever, and say that unless they had this happen with the defendant, then how else would they know? Basically, what Summit goes to is a defense where my client didn't do it. Maybe somebody else did it, but my client didn't do it.
I want to focus you back, though, on your argument to the district court of how prejudicial it was, and so you should keep it out. She's having her father's baby. How much more prejudicial? I mean, what is the extreme prejudice of a 12-year-old's knowledge of the Internet, albeit pornography, that should be excluded from a jury?
It wasn't just the Internet. It was the Internet as well as that there were claims she had other sexual conduct.
No, that's not what was argued. That's not what was argued. It wasn't sexual conduct. It was knowledge of the Internet.
It was my understanding that it was more than just that.
That's not what I read. What I read was that she would view pornography with her friends, and she watched this thing called RedTube, and they watched lots of porn, and that goes right into their defense of statutory sexual seduction, which is that she's curious, she wants to know more, and what he says to the police is, his story to the police is that basically she went on top of him while he's passed out on whatever. So it feeds right into his defense. And so my question to you is, it was not prior sexual conduct in which rape shield prevents the introduction of evidence. This was specifically knowledge of the Internet, which the district court, in fact, denied their motion. And so I suppose my question to you is, what could be so prejudicial that that could not come in? And doesn't that really go to the heart of their defense, albeit sexual seduction?
Respectfully, I disagree. I don't believe that it does go to the heart of the defense that she consented. The fact that she watches pornography on the Internet has nothing to do with consent.
When we're looking at this, though, we're not just looking at this case. We're looking at all sexual assault or seduction cases. So if you're not to look at the facts of this and you say a perpetrator over 21, a victim under 16, and their defense is statutory sexual seduction, isn't it arguable that perhaps a victim's knowledge of the Internet, of pornography, albeit curiosity, etc., might become relevant to their defense, to which a district court should not keep that out from the jury? Because part of Summit is, it's a little different than this. That's obviously explaining sexual conduct in a different type of factual setting than this case. So I guess if you look at cases where you do have teens like this particular, so if you have a victim that's 12 and a perpetrator over 21, and again, not the facts of this case, but if you look at it across the board, wouldn't that be relevant to a defense then of sexual seduction in most cases, a victim's just knowledge of the Internet? And in today's society with kids on iPhones all day, how could that be overly prejudicial?
It could be relevant in some cases, but in this particular case, it is not relevant because you have to look at this particular victim. All 12-year-olds are different. All 13-year-olds are different. All 22-year-olds are different, and all 5-year-olds are different. And what I've always argued to the Supreme Court, and I will argue to this court as well, is it's one thing to read a cold, hard transcript and hear the facts of the case below. But as district court trial judges, each of you know that when you are watching the victim testify and you're listening to what the victim, any witness, in fact, has to say, you get a whole different flavor of the case and of the person who's testifying based on their body language, based on eye contact, based on context.
But Judge Delaney didn't make that decision. She didn't make that ruling at jury. She made the ruling prior on a motion by the defense. Prior to trial, she denied the defense's request. So everything you're saying now doesn't go to how she ruled and how it may or may not have been error in this case.
I recognize that, and you asked me why there was extreme prejudice. In this particular case, if you had seen DeShea as opposed to just reading a cold, hard transcript, you would recognize that DeShea is not a normal 12-year-old. She is a very young 12-year-old. She's slow. She had an IEP in school since the second grade, and in fact, her IEP was because of slow learning. She is somebody who absolutely doesn't understand the consequences. Just because she's curious, everybody's curious. 4-year-olds try to put a bobby pin in a the electrical thing in the wall. That doesn't mean that they're old enough to consent to do that. They're curious. And DeShea could have been curious. And just because Anita says that DeShea told me that she wanted to feel what a penis was like in her and she jumped on top of him doesn't mean that that's what actually happened. If the court remembers, the defendant is extraordinarily manipulative, and he told DeShea that there were things that she should say. DeShea denied on the stand that that actually happened. She said that she said it, but she denied that that actually happened. So the fact that maybe she was curious and had been looking at pornography is prejudicial because it makes her look like something that she is not. It makes her look like somebody who is out for a good time.
But if she's looking at porn, then that is what she is. You're saying that, she's not the kind of kid who looks at porn, but if there's evidence that she is, then that's what she is.
No, I didn't say, I'm sorry, I don't mean to suggest she's the kind of kid that looks at porn, but it's not necessarily she's the kind of child that's just looking to have sex.
Why not give that to the jury?
Make the jump that because she looks at porn, she wants to have sex. And you can't equate the two with everybody, especially not with DeShea.
We're not just looking at this case as just the facts of this case. It's in all sexual assault cases, when should a district court deny such a request, which may be pertinent to their defense, i.e. a statutory sexual seduction. And here it's not disputed who the perpetrator is, it's what crime is being committed. And to not, across the board, allow in evidence where the defendant himself told the detectives exactly this, which is that she is the one that initiates sex or she's the one that got on top of me. It's what he said to the detectives. I'm not talking about what Anita may have said later on, but that's what the defendant said to the detectives. To not allow evidence which supports his theory and his defense across the board, is that something that this court wants the district courts to deny outright just because it's, each case obviously is different.
Every case is different.
How is this, in your arguments, though, to the district court, in that particular motion, when you review the transcripts, the only thing that you make reference to in the district court is it should be denied because it's just too prejudicial to go to the jury.
And it was, in my opinion, too prejudicial to go to the jury because it demonstrates something about DeShea that's not accurate. And I just don't think that you can say in every case across the board of sexual assault that you have to let this in. It has to be on a case-by-case basis. I understand that you want to make law for every case, but you can't always do that. And in this particular situation, DeShea was, maybe she was curious, but that doesn't mean that she was able to consent to sexual conduct.
That's not the argument that was made. The argument was she didn't understand the nature of the conduct, and if you allow information of other sexual activity or knowledge that she might have obtained, then that proves something about her understanding the nature of the conduct.
I don't see how watching pornography demonstrates that she understands what's going to happen if you have sex ultimately in the long run. DeShea is somebody who said that she took one-a-day vitamins because that was going to prevent pregnancy. Clearly, she doesn't understand the concept. She also said that when someone asked her, well, you're in seventh grade and you have to do homework. What are you going to do if the baby's crying and you have to do homework? She said, oh, I'll just put the baby in front of the TV.
This generally, a rule of exclusion is to protect the victim from muddying her reputation. That's what Summit says. Something being overly prejudicial. And here you have a victim coming in who's had a baby. Where's the prejudice at this point by the time trial rolls around?
And I suggest that even if that was an incorrect decision by the trial court, that it was harmless error because even if the jury had heard that she had watched porn, they were still going to find him guilty of sexual assault because of DeShea, the condition that she was in, her demeanor, her lack of ability to grasp things, and the extensive manipulation by the defendant. The letters that he wrote to her, even while he was in custody before trial, demonstrate the manipulation that she had no chance with him.
He writes to her, wait for me. You promised that you don't listen to what the people say, that you had a baby from your dad. We fell in love. Remember that I told you that you, and you told me the same thing. Save that love for me to share. Don't give it away. You belong to me and I belong to you. Don't give it away. Stay by my side forever, my love. DeShea, I need to talk to you, just me, no Anita, no caseworker, just you and me. I gave you my ring. It belongs to you. You said you are my wife, so prove it, DeShea. I have dreams that I am there with you at the foster home and someplace else. I'm just with you. Do you love me? Say that you love me. I am your baby's daddy. Are you in love with me still? Let me know. I need to know. Even immediately before the trial, he was still manipulating her. And she came into court and she testified. And I believe she backtracked still because she was still manipulated by him. This is a child who could not possibly have made a decision to enter into a sexual relationship. And the evidence that was excluded, the watching pornography, wasn't going to make a difference in any of those jurors' minds.
So why object to it?
Because I believed that it was just offered to make her look bad and not for any other purpose.
That's not that it didn't go to the heart of their defense, which is she knew more than just...
I still don't see how that goes to the heart of their defense, whether she knew or not. She, DeShea, this child, not any other 12-year-old, this child couldn't make an informed decision about sex. And unless the court has any other questions, I would ask the court.
You think in retrospect, if the court had said, well, it looks like it's prejudicial, I don't really want to allow it, but it is within the scope of the defense that's being raised, so I'll allow you 5 minutes of questioning on this topic. Would that have been a better approach? Well, if you'd like, it's like you analogize it to jury instructions. If the defense raises any evidence whatsoever, no matter how flimsy, the instruction has to be given on that area of the law. So here, the defense wants to raise it as a defense so that she understood the nature of the conduct. And so, Judge, we don't think it should be allowed, but if you do allow it, do it under very strict and narrow circumstances and give a limiting instruction to the jury to tell the jury what you can use it for and what you can't use it for so it won't have the same prejudicial effect.
If that had been the option, I assume it would not have had as much of a prejudicial effect. But I still suggest that regardless, it was harmless error. I'm not agreeing that it was error, but if the court finds it was error, it was harmless error because this case was proven by overwhelming evidence.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I think, Ms. Piper, you got off the hook. All right, Ms. Feliciano, you have, I believe I said 3 minutes. Was it two? Did I say three?
I technically only have two left, but
I'll take 2 minutes.
Well. Thank you. I'm going to start with the issue that that you just left off with the state. As far as the extreme prejudice that the state argues, down below when we were arguing the motion to avoid the extreme prejudice, I argued to the district court judge that I intended in no way to harass DA. That it was not designed in any way to represent unchaste character, that it went to the heart of our defense. And I offered that, I said that my questioning on that line would be very sanitary, and I said that I would even work with the state and the district court to craft a line of questioning that everybody could accept to make sure that we did not unduly harass DA. As to the question that Judge Silver raised, you are correct that I did not argue about other sexual conduct. It was the internet and the red tube viewing. Court's indulgence.
What about the point that was just made that this was an extremely vulnerable child, and this particular child, almost anything would have been too much?
I disagree with the position that this was an extremely vulnerable child. She, upon the disclosure, number one, she stands up to the staff at the First Choice Pregnancy Center, and she refuses to answer their questions. She refuses to answer any questions by detectives. She refuses to answer any questions by CPS. She refuses and sticks to her position and wants to stay with her father. I would say that a vulnerable...
Well, on the other side of it, if she's not vulnerable, she's subject to manipulation.
Well, and she could... I'm going to disagree that she was also subject to manipulation because of the basis of the way that their relationship, you know, had progressed. But she was able to stand up for herself. And with regard to CPS, they encouraged her to not raise the shit. May I continue?
All right, you can have one more minute.
Thank you very much. They wanted her to have DeShea Crystal adopted. DA stood up and said, no, I'm going to raise my baby. And in fact, at trial, she proudly testified with a very big smile about what a great mother she was. Just going back briefly to the extreme prejudice on the denial of the motion, I believe that the state only bolsters my argument when it says, oh, well, this is, you know, a mentally challenged child who could not possibly understand. And so by taking away our ability to present her interest and where she may have learned this, that gutted our defense. And I believe that any prejudicial value, especially in light of my concession to, you know, perhaps sanitary questioning is denied us a complete defense. Further, just to give the background, I requested the summit material in my discovery motion, discovery request number 10. The state did not oppose it. The court granted it. I made a full proffer with regard to the summit information. At the summit motion argument, we made the record that the state and I had spoken, and the state had provided me with all summit discovery.
What about the final point that was made for counsel for the state, that the facts of this case are so horrific that if there was any error, it has to be harmless error because the jury would have found him guilty anyway?
And I disagree with that it would be harmless error and the jury would have found him guilty anyway. The jury was given, as the state, you know, wants to argue, the jury was, you know, given and the state argued this is a very, you know, sympathetic witness, she has an IEP, she can't understand, and that's where we were left. You know, I mean, I had to argue exactly what I'm saying today, that she was able to stand up for herself, but without being able to present to the jury that she had looked at sexual activity, that she had an interest in it.
You didn't make an offer of proof, and I'm sorry to keep you for an extra question, but I don't recall reading what your offer of proof was besides questioning her about her visual observing. Did you actually have her friends that were going to take the stand to say that she was going to, they all watch pornography together? What was your offer of proof on that? Because I missed that in the transcripts.
And what I meant, Your Honor, is number one, to address that question, we were completely precluded from a hearing. And so we were unable to bring in her friends to testify to this.
But you obviously had this information.
We had this.
So you had witnesses then to testify to this.
Correct. When I said that I made a proffer regarding the information, in my discovery request, in my discovery motion, I outlined exactly what the information that we were looking for with regard to Summit was in my...
So it would have been in your discovery request, but not necessarily in the motions to admit this evidence. Your offer was not in there.
It was in the motion to admit as well, but that was denied without a hearing. And it was part of the discovery. The state had never objected to it. And it said, you know, in fact, we'll turn over all information. Until then, I filed my motion. Does the court have any additional
questions?
Anything else? You know, I just have one quick question. I just want to make sure, I'm looking through my notes, I want to make sure I understand what your argument is with regard to sufficiency of the evidence for the incest conviction. Are you saying that when the victim identifies the defendant as her father and the defendant admits that he is her father, those statements aren't enough to prove that he's actually her father?
Under the circumstances of this case, yes, I am saying that. Because he was not around for the birth, because Anita never told him she was pregnant with DA, because the only way that DA and Mr. Guitron learned of his possible parentage was from Anita when she needed money and sought child support, it was solely supported by hearsay. DA and Mr. Guitron had no personal knowledge themselves that they were actually biologically related. So under the circumstances of this case, I would say, yes, there's insufficient evidence to demonstrate.
Wasn't there DNA evidence for the child support matter?
Ms. Anderson testified that there was a paternity test that was done in Michigan. The state never provided any evidence of the paternity test. She did not say, you know, who the father was, and I objected to that and said that not only was that subject to the best evidence rule, it was also double hearsay because they needed to bring in the person who did the paternity test and provide the paternity test. There was no testimony that, you know, DNA was taken.
Let me ask you this. Incest statutes go back hundreds of years.
Yes.
In the world before DNA tests and paternity tests, how were incest convictions ever prosecuted?
Well, going back...
Or are you saying they all should have been overturned because there was never DNA and paternity tests?
No, I'm not saying that at all. Typically, in incest cases, we know that people are related within the degree of consanguinity. And that's because, you know, the family grows up together and knows, you know, the relationships between each other. I'm saying that under the unique circumstances of this case, where we have a 10-year gap between, say, when there was sexual intercourse and when Mr. Guitron was contacted by this family, that this is not enough to establish the incest charge. Additionally, Ms. Anderson had other children by other men, both before and after, and that lends some credibility to the theory that the state was required to bring more to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that DA and Mr. Guitron were in fact related and that the crime of incest occurred.
But if he was tested in Michigan and he was told the results and then he acted on those results as if he believed that they were true, held himself out to be the father, it might not even be hearsay. I mean, it's just his own belief that he's the father and he had a basis to believe it.
There was nothing to support that he was given the results by Michigan. He was given the results by Ms. Anderson. And so, again, that goes back to the objection that the state should have established
He acknowledged, though, to the detectives that paternity tests were taken and that he was the father.
And that would still be based on, for introduction into, I mean, it is a statement by him, but to establish beyond a reasonable doubt the paternity test, the state should have introduced the actual results of that paternity test. He didn't say how it was taken, how it was conducted, or how he learned of it.
So what is the corpus delicti? As Judge Tao pointed out, DNA didn't exist that long ago for proof in court.
It did not. The state relied heavily and in its closing argument stated that parentage was shown here because of Mr. Guitron's admissions that he was her father, his statements that he was her father, and the letters that he was her father. That was the sole basis for their argument to establish parentage.
But that's parentage. That's an issue for the jury. The corpus delicti is what? The child?
The corpus delicti is that the incest charge is trying to be established, consanguinity is trying to be established through his statements alone, his statements and his letters addressing DA as his daughter. That's the issue there.
Okay.
Corpus delicti, by the way, was first time talked about today, so that's an interesting concept.
Thank you for giving us that one, too, to look at. Does the court have any additional questions?
Hey, no. You did a very good job. Thank you very much, counsel for the state. Very good job, too. This is obviously a fascinating case. The facts are pretty tough.
Fascinating is one way to put it.
Yes. All right. We'll take this matter under submission and, of course, have a written order at a later point in time. I want to thank everybody again for being here today.